Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back astronomer Bob Berman to field your astronomy-related questions. He is one of the best-known and most widely read astronomers in the world. Bob can translate even difficult things into terms that I can understand, which is amazing, really. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post your comments at the bottom of today's show page on the Vox Pop section of our website, wamc.org/VoxPop. You can comment below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. By the way, I put a picture of Bob holding the meteorite that he brought in on our Facebook page, so you can check that out. You can also tweet your questions at WAMC Vox Pop. All right, with that out of the way, we welcome back Bob Berman. Hiya, Bob.
Great to be here, Ray. Thanks.
So this is pretty exciting. You brought a chunk of rock that is maybe 5 inches across, and it weighs, what, 8 pounds,
weighs
10 pounds?
Lot. Yeah. Yes. They're pretty dense.
This is really something. This is an iron-ish meteorite?
Yep, nickel iron called an octahedrite, landed in Argentina in the 1500s.
Wow. And, I mean, as I asked you off mic, how do you know it's a meteorite? I mean, how do you know it's not something that somebody just had in their house?
Well, other than the fact that it's very heavy for its size.
But iron is heavy, right?
The true. It'll pull on a magnet. And, of course, it's not the only thing in the world that will pull on a magnet.
Well, is that one of our things that you're...
No.
Demagnetizing?
Okay.
All right. Fair enough.
Key hiding thing
okay.
for the car.
Yeah.
And that has a black fusion crust. But the real giveaway, other than that it's pitted and looks like a meteorite, it's got these odd dimples in it that are called regmaglyphs.
Okay.
I don't know how many words end with Y-P-T-S, but regmaglyphs or Crips. Thumbprints, which if it were soft clay and you stuck your thumb in a few places, you'd make those kind of dimples in the rock. And meteorites have them. Almost all of them have that, and almost no earthly rocks do.
So no, how do they get them?
On their way in, as they come through the atmosphere.
Heating up?
Yes, that's right. And it's one of the injuries they get coming through. So it's one of the giveaways. A lot of people think they've found a meteorite in their driveway or such, but only 13 have been discovered in all of New York State's history.
Only 13 meteorites?
That's right. So it's
And these fall all the time.
They do. I mean, the streaks that we see in the sky called meteors, 6 an hour after midnight, are almost always burning up into dust.
Mm.
But there are falls. It's just that they, after a few years, they get rusty. They blend in with the other rocks, and hard to find, except in the Antarctic.
Now, how old would this one be?
This one landed in the 1500s.
No, but I mean... When was it made? When?
Oh! Almost every meteorite is a piece of an asteroid, mm-hmm. which are those chunks left over from the formation of the solar system. Most of them between Mars and Jupiter safely, but some of them, the Apollo class, cross Earth's orbit, like that one that hit in Siberia.
Okay.
And then we can have trouble from them. Although I don't know if it's always trouble. The one that landed 65 million years ago, that divided the Cretaceous and Tertiary periods of Earth, destroyed the dinosaurs, as we all know,
yeah.
and let us mammals come into ascendancy. So I don't know if you'd call it bad luck.
Certainly bad luck for the dinosaurs.
For the dinosaurs, but look around us. We wouldn't have sitcoms and rats and all the good things around us if it weren't for that event.
Well, since you put it that way, sitcoms and rats. So the meteor that hit Russia this, was it 2 weeks ago now?
Yeah, the 15th.
Okay, so that was... How big?
Well, probably the size of a car. They're saying something in the area of 7,000 pounds. So when you think of 7,000 pounds, what do you have to be? I mean, it's pretty dense material. What size do you have to be to... to have that. I said pounds, I mean tons. 7,000
tons. That's a lot of
tons. Probably something between a car and a bus size.
Okay. And this, I mean, if the estimates are to be believed, on orders of magnitude larger than the atomic bombs dropped in Japan.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's a lot of energy.
Yeah, like it would be 30 times what a Hiroshima bomb, 500 kilotons. On the other hand, the last time this happened, on June 30th, 1908, also over Siberia, this story just gets weirder and weirder, it was at least 2.5 megatons that time. That was enough to knock down trees, you'll recall, for 50 miles in all directions. This one didn't knock down a single tree. It was enough of air pressure disturbance to knock windows inward, obviously, but not to destroy a single tree. So that last one was much worse.
1-800-348-2551 is the number. Bob Berman is our guest, if you haven't guessed. 1-800-348-2551. So the timing, of course, and you wrote about this on our website, or I believe you wrote about it on our website, the timing was ridiculous because here we are waiting for this asteroid to pass within the orbits of our geosynchronous satellites, 17,000 miles, and then 12 hours before, this chunk, which allegedly had nothing to do with it, smashes into Russia.
Yeah, this is just so strange. This was the closest asteroid in memory, maybe the closest asteroid of our lives, passing just 17,000 miles, 2012 DA-14. And then on that same day, we have this greatest airburst in over a century. I'm just so glad this didn't happen on the day of the Mayan calendar.
Oh, I wish it did.
Because then there'd be no talking those people into in convincing them that the Maya didn't have prophecy. In fact, I would have gone over to their side. I would have said, okay, I believe it.
You believe it now.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, getting back to the coincidence of this, and of course, coincidences happen all the time, but isn't it possible that here's this huge asteroid coming? Not huge in the astronomical sense, but huge for if it smashed into Earth, it would be darn big.
Right.
Isn't it possible that this thing, which they've been tracking a year, had some little pebbles in its wake before
well,
and after?
And of course, you're right. You think Occam's razor, you think of logic. That's the first thing that crosses your mind. But no, the one that came into Siberia was moving between 10 and 12 miles a second, and it was coming in from the northeast. But the one that we've been tracking, that is DA-14, was much slower, was only 4.8 miles per second, and that came in from the south. So two different directions, okay. Two different speeds, unrelated.
All right, 1-800-348-2551, the number. Let's go to Peter in Schenectady. Peter, you're on with Bob Berman.
Yes, good afternoon. I've been following this meteor story very closely and with interest. Been interested in astronomy ever since I was a kid. And based on the statistics or what they've said the size of this meteor is and the way it looked, and I haven't heard any mention of the Shkolkia-Lyn meteor in the 40s that fell in Siberia or in way out west, western Russia, which appears to be much closer in size to this. Even the drawing that the artist made when the meteor came in, the Shkolkia-Lyn meteor, looks almost identical to the cloud that this thing made. Did you have any comments on that? Or?
Well, in terms of air bursting and the sonic boom and the damage it did to all those windows, thanks to just really normal human behavior, you know, you see a flash and you see a streak in the sky, of course you're going to go to the window.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, then the windows blew inward. This was larger, much larger than that in terms of the intensity of the sonic boom. That's why this is said to be the largest since that time. And I hope, since you're interested in astronomy, I hope if we have the time that we can get into the ones that actually make it to the ground. And you know, this one had fragments that did that, but the ones that have stories to tell.
What do you mean?
Well, you had one person in human history injured, one authenticated case, that was Ann Hodges in Sylacauga, Alabama, on the last day of November in 1954, that made Life magazine, where it came in through the ceiling. And this is common. You get a chunk. If it doesn't burn up and if it doesn't blow up, air resistance, if it's in the 1 to 100 pound range, and most meteoroids are, will only come in at 250 miles an hour. Mm. Miles an hour.
Yeah.
So that's enough to penetrate a roof, penetrate the ceiling below, and usually not one additional floor. So here's something that just happens over and over again. We've had this right around here in our own listening area. Mm. You get a sudden noise, person rushes to the next room. There's a hole in the ceiling, damage in the room, and they find this black stone somewhere in the room. This has happened repeatedly, and that's what happened back in 1954, except this was the time that it bounced off a radio and actually struck her in the hip and the in one of her hands, producing the only known case of injury from them. But we've had damage right around here.
Go ahead, Peter.
I read that the... Okay, I read that the Shkolkin-Lynn meteor happened over in an isolated area. There was no city that it was over, and that it also produced a sonic boom. I don't know if you, I'm sure you're familiar with that fall as well, or...
Well, I've heard of many, 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 and many produce sonic booms, and I've seen bolides myself. Every astronomer has. But so you're only talking about, we're always talking about degrees. Is this bigger than this? Is this event more spectacular than the other one? And that's the you know, most of them happen over the ocean, and then we don't get to see them at all. But there's some again returning, and I know this is not what you asked about airbursts, but just getting back to ones that actually did damage. The most spectacular was the family, Wanda and Robert Donahue. I know because I spoke to them in Wethersfield, Connecticut, in November of 1982, where the meteor came through the ceiling again of the next room. They rushed in, saw that it had bounced around because there were scuff marks on the rug and on the ceiling.
Yeah.
And
I read about that one, yeah.
And they generously donated it to a museum. By the way, do you think insurance covered them?
Probably not. Peter, we got to take a break.
I asked them, and they said it did. Every penny.
Really?
Yep.
Well, that's a good policy. Zach, let's take a break now. We'll get back with Bob Berman. More on meteors and your astronomical questions coming up on Vox Pop.
Support for WAMC comes from Boyden & Perron, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts. A family-owned business for over 50 years, BoydenandPerron.com. The Garrison in the Hudson Highlands, featuring restaurants, golf, getaway packages, special event planning, and nearby cultural attractions. TheGarrison.com. Sunflower Natural Foods Market, Woodstock, introducing health counselor Luis Mojica, helping identify foods and supplements geared towards heart health. Saturdays 1 to 9, Sundays 11 to 7, Facebook, Twitter, and sunflowernatural.com. In New York State, tobacco-free community partners working to help parents prevent and reduce youth smoking with prevention programs to counter tobacco marketing and help save lives. New York State tobacco-free community partners at smokefreecapital.org.
Fox Pop on WAMC. Bob Berman is our guest. Astronomy is the topic. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. So in 1982, you said, in Wethersfield, Connecticut.
It happened. And the weird thing is, because normally a home is struck every year and a half in average in North America, but it just so happened it had been 11 years since a home had been struck.
Yeah.
And the time before that, which was 1971, the time before that a town was hit, a house was hit by a meteor, was the same town of Wethersfield, Connecticut.
Wow.
Now, what are the chances of the same town being struck consecutively? The only reason that we can come up with is that it's a suburb of Hartford where all the insurance companies are.
Well, I mean, you know, that's a punchline. But, I mean, meteor, these things are, you can't predict when they'll hit. But,
no.
I mean, they travel in packs that you can predict, right?
Exactly. Well, no.
I mean, we travel into them, right?
Yes, and the things that are really predictable are the meteor showers that we all enjoy. The one
but
every
this was not related
11th.
To that?
They're not related because those are comet fragments which could never survive their trip through the atmosphere.
Oh.
So when we see meteor showers, like in the summer, we're safe from those. Those can never hit us. Unlike the event in 2003 in a Chicago suburb where, again, came through the ceiling, except this one hit a printer of a teenager
yeah.
who's still up at midnight, not surprisingly, bounced off, broke a mirror, just missed him by a couple of feet.
Hmm.
So these kind of things happen.
Well, you mentioned comets, and, you know, we talked about the 1908 Tunguska event. Now, there has been speculation that this particular one in 1908 not a meteor, but a comet coming in and air bursting, right?
Right, because when we say meteor, we're really talking about some generic object coming into Earth's atmosphere. It could be a fragment of a comet. They don't make it to the ground anyway. So if an icy mixed with stone object came in, yeah, we'd expect it to blow up. It could be an asteroid, could be anything. So we weren't there. There were no fragments found. So there's no way to analyze that it was an air-bursting comet or an asteroid. But if you find a chunk, and if you find a chunk, the name changes. Now it's a meteorite.
Right. That's on the ground.
And that's almost always an asteroid, although we have about a dozen fragments from the moon and about a dozen fragments from Mars that have landed.
Very interesting. Very interesting. Of course, in the 1908 event, if you, you found no, all these years you have found no pieces, does that then tend to lend a different theory? In other words, this one in Russia, they've already found pieces of this thing recently.
Right.
But the one in 1908, all that damage and all those trees down, nobody found a piece yet. So what does that tell you?
Well, it could have been, it tells me that it could have been fragile. It could have been indeed a comet. Or it could have just been burning up into dust and then finally did a final boom that destroyed the whole thing and all that was left were dust fragments.
All right, back to the phones we go with Bob Berman, 1-800-348-2551. Stephen and Rensselaer, you're on.
Yes, my question is, for many years I sort of always assumed that the asteroid belt was a broken-up planet, and I, for some reason I seem to think that the name of that theoretical planet was Vulcan, for what that's worth. And then I read somewhere that that's not true because the amount of material in the broken up asteroids is not, there's not enough for a planet. And so I just wondered what the latest thinking on that is, and also incidentally, why the theory behind the creation of the asteroid belt was, was it some other maybe smaller body that was brought, that was broken up into pieces, and how would that have worked that it'd be broken up?
Right. No, we no longer believe that, but I remember the time when we thought, and it was a wonderful sci-fi type thing, that it was a world that blew up. Maybe it had a civilization like ours. They destroyed themselves. It was great stuff. Vulcan was actually usually used for the hypothetical planet that would be inside Mercury's orbit, closer to the sun than Mercury. This hypothetical planet was something else, but no, all the evidence now suggests that this was left over from the planetesimals that used to rule the solar system. In other words, when the nebula from which we condensed, we meaning the planets and the sun in the core, we really started from globs of smaller chunks that by their own self-gravity glommed together to form the various planets. But in between Mars and Jupiter, thanks to Jupiter's extreme gravity, there was too much gravitational and tidal tugging to allow a planet to form, even a small one.
But isn't that a kind of a perfect gap, a slot, if you will, where a planet, you'd expect a planet to
be? That's right. In fact, the old Bode-Titius law is really just a mathematical relationship that tells us where planets should be, places one right in that spot where most of the asteroids are. So that was the place where a planet would have formed but couldn't.
Ah.
So all we have left is the debris. And that's why asteroids are interesting to planetary astronomers, because they represent material left over from the formation of the solar system, the primordial material that...
Sure, go ahead, Stephen.
One last question. Is all the thinking that Mars's moons are captured asteroids?
Yeah, probably just because they're such little chunks of garbage, you know, 15 miles across. How can you? I wish they had two different words. They had moons for something like our moon at 2160 miles in diameter, or Titan, or Ganymede, that's over 3,000 miles in diameter, bigger than Mercury, the planet Mercury. And then you had moonlet, maybe, for these little captured odd things like Phobos and Deimos, which are strange just because of, you know, what they mean. How many things in the solar system are named fear and death?
Yeah.
You know,
nice.
Little things. And they're little irregular chunks. A completely different animal.
Stephen, thanks a lot for the call. 1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. 1-800-348-2551. Jerry in New Paltz, you're on. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you. Just, I would say, like, 2 months ago, after my pond in the backyard had frozen over, I woke up one morning to seeing several consecutive rings, kind of like frozen ripples. And I was just kind of wondering, trying to figure out what would have made that. I mean, the biggest ring was probably maybe like 40, 50 feet in diameter. And it looked too odd for maybe a bird landing. And because of the ripples in the frozen pond, and what would have caused that? So we thought maybe it was a meteor. But my original thought was, do they come down at an angle? And would it have ripped the ice up? Or would it just come straight down and just make a little circle?
Okay. Usually at an angle. And, you know, unlikely, but, you know, not impossible. And if you feel like putting on some scuba gear and getting under there and checking it out, you know, you can.
How big do you think it would be?
Well, remember, I said that they come in at about 250 miles an hour. So think of the damage something traveling at that speed would do or how deep it would go. In 1991, two boys in Noblesville, Indiana, were standing on the front lawn just talking to each other, one astride his bicycle, when a meteorite came in and went whoomp right into the lawn right next to them. And it made not a crater, but just like it was just slightly embedded and giving a lie to the myth that they're hot. In truth, the atmosphere, the cold air pretty much freezes them on the way down. They're barely warm to the touch. And one of them walked over and was able to pick it up right away. And it was a meteorite. So that gives you the idea. No, not fast enough to make a crater.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot, Jerry. We appreciate the call. Let's go over to Paul in Esopus. Paul.
Hi there. I was wondering if you could go over the definition of a planet again. I'm a little confused ever since the demotion of Pluto, and now they've announced they found a planet around some other star that's even smaller than the moon. I thought Pluto had been demoted because of its size, but it's bigger than the moon, isn't it?
All right.
Yes, the moon is 2,160 miles in diameter, and Pluto is 1,400 miles in diameter. So Pluto is only two-thirds the size of our moon. But that's not the only reason it was demoted. It was we lived with it for a while as the only planet that has a significant axial orbital tilt to the flat plane of the solar system. It has a 17-degree tilt. It has an eccentricity. That means an out-of-roundness of 0.25, which is the greatest eccentricity, and all the it's very tiny, and it's not an it but a they, because there's two chunks that are almost the same size. Usually we call them Pluto and Charon. It's spelled Charon. People would say Charon, but it's really Charon, pronounced Charon. And with all these oddities, we were willing to leave it as a planet. But then came the final straw. We realized that out there in the Kuiper belt of icy objects, icy bodies, we started finding more objects of the same size, finally found one bigger, Eris. So after discovering Quarwar and Sedna and Charon, now Eris, and Eris being bigger, we realized there's lots of these things out there. They're all tiny. They all have these high eccentricities. So we have two choices. They have to be planets, too. If Eris is bigger than Pluto, it's got to be promoted to a planet. And we're going to eventually have dozens or maybe hundreds of planets. And all the teenage boys like myself who used to have planet posters on their wall and could memorize their names, we're not going to be able to memorize the names if there's hundreds of them. Okay. And we realize, you know, there's two real classes of these things. There's these tiny, icy, eccentric things, and then there is the eight other bodies that have different kinds of orbits, different kind of compositions. So it was really obvious that you had to make a different category.
Okay, but if Pluto's orbit was more like the other eight planets, it would be considered a planet still?
That was only one of the things that was odd. It was the orbit, it was the tilt, it was the composition, and all of them together as an aggregate, and the fact that it had companions that was similar to itself. Okay. That was really the final straw.
Paul, thanks a lot for the call. All right, very good. And all of these extra bodies that are out there, they all have orbits that you can track as well?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Let's go to Bob and Saugerties. Bob.
Oh, yes. I was wondering about those huge boulder-like meteorites that I would see at the Hayden Planetarium. I haven't heard mention of these monsters in regards to recent news about meteorites. Can you tell us anything about these big guys?
Oh, I remember it from my childhood myself. That wonderful, huge meteorite, really looking like a meteorite. I believe that was an octahedrite too. That was on display at the American Museum of Natural History, Hayden Planetarium. That was from Greenland originally, and they even had a billboard showing how it was hauled. I mean, it really weighed so much. How it was hauled by horses and sledges and taken by boat and then brought to New York. And it was found in Greenland. I don't remember, and I don't even think they know when it had originally landed, but it was a beautiful specimen. I still hope they have it at that less interesting Rose Planetarium that's now taken the place of the Hayden Planetarium. I hope they still have that on display there.
We put it hard to get rid of.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah, you're right. You couldn't even put it on the curb and ask the sanitation department to take it. They wouldn't. But who would want to, anyway?
All right. Bob, thank you. All right, then. So the meteorite that you have here is mostly nickel and iron, right?
Right.
And you told me before the show that you can tell, there are several ways you can tell that it's actually from outer space. And one of them is if you were to, I don't know what you
call
it.
Those thumbprint-looking things.
But if you would etch it.
Yes.
And that would tell, there's a pattern in the chemical makeup or whatever the signature that you see that tells you it's from space. And my question is, I mean, isn't the Earth ultimately made up of the same stuff that's out there? Wouldn't we have the same signature if you dig deep enough?
No, because of the way the crystals form in these things, the way the pattern is on the nickel iron, and chemistry is not primarily my field. It's just kind of an auxiliary field for this. But if you sawed with a very powerful blade a piece of a nickel iron meteor and you put acid on it, you'd get this Widmanstätten pattern, as it's called. It looks like tic-tac-toe marks that you really don't get from terrestrial rock. So that's the way to close the case. Unfortunately, you've just destroyed the meteorite to do it.
Well, how much do you need? I mean, we could take a little piece of this thing off, right?
True. That's true, but I'm not going to let you.
All right. Well, how would I do it right here? I could try, I suppose. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. Let's go over to George in East Hampton. George, you're on.
Hello. How are you?
Good.
I just have a question about Pluto. Given that you have two bodies there that are roughly the same size, is it possible that at one point they were part of the same construction, they got broken apart?
I guess it is. Pluto's the only, when it was a planet, it was the only one where both bodies had a captured rotation of, if I remember right, 6.4 days. In other words, with us and the moon, and we're the second most, by the way, in terms of closeness of size. The moon is only one quarter our diameter. The moon is captured. It as we all know, it always points one face toward us because its rotation equals its revolution period, 27.32166 days. And I'm giving it to you with that precision to tell you how exactly, precisely, its day and its month, if that's what we want to call its revolution around us, are matched so that it always points one side toward us, which, by the way, almost all of the nearly 200 moons in the solar system do. They're all captured rotations like that. But Pluto itself spun in the same rate at which Charon went around it. So both of them had one hemisphere facing each other, like they were eyeball to eyeball. They both rotated like that. That's how close they were to each other. It was only a 2-to-1 ratio of diameters. How they evolved, they were no doubt part of the same body from the beginning, I would think. Whether they broke off, I don't know. I mean, most of the asteroids we see, if not all of them, are the results of collisions with other asteroids, and so they've broken off. It's something that happens.
Could we at some point send a spaceship to Pluto and have it land on Pluto or Charon and determine whether they were part of the same body?
Maybe we could. You know, the New Horizons spacecraft is on its way to Pluto and will be there in only another 2.5 years. But it's not going to land. It's just going to it's just going to visit, right? So we're not going to have any samples. As a little bit of Jeopardy trivia, this is the only spacecraft yet that was launched toward one type of object and will arrive at a different, because it was launched towards a planet.
Oh, very clever. I'll take underwriting breaks for 10, Alex. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. We'll take the aforementioned underwriting break. We'll be right back.
Support for WAMC comes from Carrie Haddad Gallery, Hudson, New York, presenting abstract paintings by Adam Cohen and Mexican photographic portraits by Russell Monk through this Sunday, CarrieHaddadGallery.com. Cafe Capriccio, Chef Jim Rua, working to preserve and maintain the traditions of Italian cuisine and hospitality since 1982 on Grand Street in Albany, New York, CafeCapriccio.com. Saratoga Health and Wellness, a fitness facility offering exercise, nutrition, personal training, and weight loss programs, SaratogaHealthandWellness.com. And the Honest Wade Food Co-op in Albany, offering local and organic produce, natural groceries, artisan cheeses, and more, HonestWade.coop.
Vox Pop on WAMC. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. Bob Berman is our guest, and boy, I tell you, it'll be an exciting year for comet viewing.
Oh, it is. You know, every 15 to 20 years on average, we get what's called a great comet.
And okay. That's, and how do you define a great comet?
Great comet is one that's bright enough to be seen over cities.
Okay.
That'll fight its way through light pollution.
And the last one was
And the
Hale
last
Bop?
One is, well, we had two in a row, which was really weird. We had Hale Bopp, right, and Yakutake on successive years in 1995 and 96. That was very strange. Before that, you had to go back to Halley's Comet in 1986-87.
Which really was a letdown.
It was. It turned out it was the worst visit of Halley in 2,000 years.
Yeah. Well, there, that's my
We were on the wrong side of the sun when it went around the sun at its perihelion. Really too bad. Next time around in 2067,
yes,
we should have the best visit in centuries.
Okay. Well, we might make that.
2061. Sorry.
Okay.
2061.
But there are some that are coming this year, right?
Oh, yeah. So this year, first of all, we thought we were going to have a great comet coming up in just a couple of weeks. We thought that on March 12th, 13th, coming up in just two weeks from now, on Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night, and it'll still be there, a comet called Pan-STARRS. We thought it would be magnitude minus 2, in other words, as bright as Jupiter, which is pretty bright in the sky. Now it's proven not to have brightened up in the last few weeks the way it was expected, and now it looks like it'll be a magnitude plus 2 comet. Now that's about as bright as the North Star or the stars of the Big Dipper. That's not really bright enough to bulldoze its way through twilight, and this comet's going to be very low in the west. Look for it on March 12th next to the crescent moon, but in twilight, and something of that brightness in twilight, I don't know, maybe you'll need binoculars to see it.
You travel north, you'd see it, right? No?
No, not even then. It's just always going to be, I mean, I'm going to be in Alaska at that time. I will be north, and it's not going to help. I don't expect to see it without binoculars. But what could be the brightest comet of our lives, Comet Ison, is on its way. It's now at the distance of Jupiter. It's heading straight toward us, actually straight toward the sun.
Okay.
And in November, it should be bright enough to be easily seen with the naked eye. In fact, I'm bringing a group of people down to the Atacama Desert of Chile to catch it first, both because the skies are perfect there and we've got some special private observatories. People who are interested in that, go to Berman Astronomy Tours.
Yeah.
You'll get all the information on that. Come on. Come with us. Join us to the Atacama Desert, one of the great places on Earth. And we're going to catch that before it reaches perihelion. And the reason is, when it skims by the sun a couple of days after Thanksgiving, it'll pass so close to the sun, and we're talking about less than a sun width from the sun, that the sun could destroy it.
Okay.
The sun has destroyed other comets that have come that close, or it might not. If it doesn't, then the opening week of December should give us a beautiful comet seen from right here. It should be gorgeous from here if the sun doesn't destroy it.
So, in other words, we will not really have good viewing in November in these parts?
Not really. It'll be better from... If you could get to a really dark site, the problem is the moon is going to start interfering just when the comet starts getting brighter and brighter and brighter.
Yeah.
So if you're in a really nice spot with and the comet's going to get lower and lower. So that's why we're balancing where to be on Earth with catching the comet at its best before it passes near the sun. But after it passes the sun, if it's still around in one piece, it'll be low, but it should be brilliant. And that'll be in early December.
What do you think the odds are that it will not make it past the sun?
I think it'll probably will make it past the sun.
Hmm. Okay, let's go back to the phones at 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman, our guest. We go to Willie in New Paltz. Willie, you're on.
Hi, Bob. This is Willie Yee from the Mid-Hudson Astronomical Association.
Hi, Willie.
Hi. In reference to your earlier caller about the meteorite at the American Museum of Natural History, there is one there now. I don't know if it's the same one he was talking about. It's the Willamette meteorite.
Right. Famous.
And that is 15.5 tons. It is still there.
I hope their floor is reinforced.
Well, I have a picture of me standing right next to it. It's quite an impressive object. And when you come on April 16th to SUNY New Paltz to present to us, I will have a picture of me with it.
Oh, great.
Look forward to seeing you.
Willie, thanks. Appreciate it. Let's go to Joanna in South Hadley. Joanna.
Hi there. I have more of a big picture question that revolves less around the objects in the sky than around our investment in finding out about the objects in the sky. I'm old enough to remember the landing on the moon and my mother getting up late at night to see Sputnik going overhead before that. And I must say I continue to question billions of dollars being spent to send sophisticated equipment to Mars or other objects in the sky when God only knows there's a lot to be done here on this Earth. So I just wonder if you could, and I realize you're an astronomer, so it's asking you a question about something dear to your heart, but can you talk a little bit about what you feel the cost benefits are, both the costs and the benefits to this?
Fair question.
It's a fair question, and it's almost impossible to answer because there's so many viewpoints. On the one hand, it's true that people have their turf. People in the rocket community and in the research community, we go to Mars every 26 months because we can, because that's when Earth and Mars align. We always come up with new questions. We probably will always come up with new questions. These things are expensive. Some of the missions have been $1 billion. Per. As you know, we were going to return to the moon. President Obama killed that mission. It would have been perhaps $50 billion. And some at that time said, why? We've been there. We've done that. We've answered most questions. People aren't going to be interested in a repeat of going to the moon. Nobody could ever colonize it. It's even though we now know there's water in some of the craters, it's just too brutal. There's too much radiation. There's no atmosphere. And so these are very good questions. And sometimes when you see a mission green-lighted, I've just seen a mission called something like Osiris Rex. Now, I'm not getting that right, but it's a new mission just green-lighted by Congress last year to spend $1 billion to go to an asteroid and get a little tiny piece of it weighing a few ounces, less than a Big Mac, and bring it back. Others are saying, hey, $1 billion, pieces of asteroids land on Earth all the time. And just like what happened on February 15th in Siberia, we get pieces that are pretty darn fresh. How much fresher do you want them?
Yeah.
I mean, why spend $1 billion on that? And as for a manned mission to Mars, that would be astronomically expensive. When in truth, we could send robot probes at a fraction of the cost and do that. So the argument goes, we have pressing needs at home. Shouldn't we attend to them first? The answer usually is, yeah, sure, but the government, it's not as if we're going to take that money and spend wisely. More likely than not, the government's going to waste the money or spend it on the military. You know, so you can go back and forth with these all the time. And I think what you're saying has validity, and I think the right answer is somewhere in between the two extremes.
Joanna, thanks a lot for the call. I mean, but isn't the other side of this, hey, look at the benefits we got just in the technological advances from the moon program.
Tang and Velcro.
Well, right. Well, of course. And who could live without Tang? But, I mean, there are so many things one could probably point to that developed or offshoots of research necessary to make space exploration possible, even in its infancy, that one could say, well, I mean, the benefits to mankind, they're also there.
It's true. There is one thing that should be noted, though, and that is our learning about deep space objects. For example, in the early 50s, the brand new 200-inch telescope on Palomar Mountain discovered that the Andromeda Galaxy was three times farther away than we'd thought. Mm-hmm. And instantly, the universe became three times larger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to astronomers, this was amazing stuff. The Andromeda Galaxy is not 750,000 light years. It's 2.1 million light years. The universe is bigger than we ever thought. We were excited. But some people were saying, how does that benefit me or any human being? In what way? Give me one example. Are we healthier? Are we better fed? How does knowing that the universe is this size instead of this size benefit anybody? And then the honest answer is it's food for the soul. It's food for our intellects, for our curiosities. It's not practical. And what I think that we don't, and this last caller brought up a point, and I think what we're not being honest with is saying that many of these explorations will not benefit us in any kind of practical way. It'll benefit us in terms of our knowledge.
Well, yes.
And in a way, that's more noble.
I would reject this is not valid, because if our ultimate, if man's ultimate goal to be here is to figure out why we're here and what we are, then learning things like, oh, the universe is at least three times bigger than we thought, vastly important.
Okay. I don't argue with that.
All right. Let's go to John in somewhere in Massachusetts.
It's great, great to get Ray riled up, though.
Hi, John. You're on the air.
I was wondering if, the other thing is that now the motivation is that industry, private corporations are spending money on the space program where it's not all governmental anymore. So that's really kind of a cool thing. But my question is that I was wondering how earthquakes affect both affects the moon, and it also affects our orbit in the greater scheme of things. Does it shift it? Does these...
Okay. First the Earth and then the moon. The shifts...
Whoops. I guess he'll just listen to the answer off the...
The shifts on our axis rarely amount to more than a foot. As Earth spins, it's not our orbit around the sun. That never affects... that's never affected by earthquakes. But our axial spin changes. And there's an annual motion deviation that's only about 40 feet. And then there's another wobble that has about a 1.2-year periodicity called the Chandler wobble that was mostly due to oceans shifting in their salinity and some atmospheric fluctuations in the year also. There is the Earth Rotation Service used to be responsible for monitoring this, because latitude and longitude lines and surveys and maps are dependent on those, those lines that show where everything is. It depends on where the North Pole and the South Pole are located. So there are shifts, but they never amount to more than 100 feet. And when there's a major earthquake, they can shift by about a foot or so. So this is very, very minor on Earth. On the moon, however, when the moon gets struck by a large meteor or meteoroid, or when a discarded piece of the Apollo mission, for example, the unneeded ascent stage was sent back crashing onto the moon's surface, a very strange thing happened. The moon would start shaking, and it would continue shaking. It was like ringing like a giant gong for up to 2.5 hours. Now, on Earth, our vibrations, our earthquakes dampen out within a minute or two. On the moon, it went on for hours.
Why? Hollow?
No, just we assume that the reason is that the moon has a solid, crystalline almost core that allows earthquake waves to completely travel back and forth and oscillate and not dampen out, whereas we have a liquid outer core that dampens out such oscillations. So the caller's question is actually very interesting, how our two bodies differ when we're struck like that.
Makes sense. 1-800-348-2551 is the number as we hit the home stretch with Bob Berman. Let's go back to the phones of Tom in Steventown. Tom, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have three quick questions. Do the poles, the North and South Pole, affect the size of meteorites or where they land, considering that the poles are magnetic and these bits of rock are iron? And then the rock from Argentina, how do you know that it's from the 1500s? And where have the meteorites in New York State landed? You mentioned there are 13 sites in the state. I was curious about all those three things.
We know one landed in the back of a lady's car. We know that.
That's right. That's right. That was a really great one in Peekskill, New York on October 9th. I believe it was 1992. Michelle Knapp was the girl. She was only 18 years old at the time. Heard a crunch, ran outside to the street, and her Chevy Malibu, 10-year-old Malibu, the trunk was grotesquely smashed in. This changed her life because ultimately a collector offered her, and she accepted, $69,000.
Wow.
For the stone. And for the, he wanted the car also, which went on exhibit around the world. She said, sure, because I can tell you the manufacturer's warranty didn't cover that, and the insurance didn't cover that either. So
that was one.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's one we know of in New York. I don't know where the other ones are. These are mostly finds rather than falls that people discovered. Now, you asked several different questions. Can the magnetism of the poles draw in a meteor because they are nickel iron and subjected to a magnetic field? The answer is no, because our magnetic field isn't stronger at the poles. The only thing that happens at the poles is that magnetic field lines are vertical. They head downward at the south magnetic pole, which oddly enough is the one in the north.
Yeah.
But we won't even go there. And they head upward, but they're vertical. In other words, they run the magnetic field lines run essentially parallel to the surface on the rest of the Earth, but they're vertical at the poles. But the magnetism isn't any stronger in those places. So no, nothing's going to, not to mention that Earth's magnetic field is pretty wimpy. You know that if you balance a little needle on a pin and a compass, it barely turns to match it to line up with north-south. It's obviously not going to affect a 10-pound chunk of rock coming in at 10 miles a second through the air. That's not going to change its trajectory, not even close. Okay.
How do you know that rock is from the 1500s, the one in Argentina?
Oh, because natives at that time saw an event, called those stones, in fact, its name in Spanish, it translates to the field of the sky. And they use those rocks because of the high metallic content for centuries to make things like blades and axes and things like that, because it was a highly concentrated, rare, highly concentrated form of nickel and iron. And you can even still buy them if you look up Argentinian octahedrite. Of course, how are you going to remember this online or on YouTube? There's one fellow who went down there and brought back tons of the stuff. I don't know if it's literal tons, but you can buy these samples, these meteorites, cheaper than I've seen them anywhere else. So people who would like to have a genuine meteorite in their living room for people to hold and to draw magnets to, it's very, very cool.
Isn't that the potential for fraud fairly high, though?
But these are I believe it's called a meteorite madness is the site. And if it says octahedrite, I've authenticated it. In fact, I've gotten several schools to buy samples, which are in cases even now. It's one of those rare times where you can get hold of a meteorite without paying a fortune.
And it's just so cool to hold a meteorite in your hand.
Thanks for taking my call.
Hey, thanks a lot. We're out of time anyway. Well, Bob, this was exciting. It really was nice to have you here again, and thanks for bringing samples for us all. And thanks to everybody who called in today. We apologize if you didn't make it through. You can go online and make a comment on our Facebook page at WAMC Radio or on our website, wamc.org/voxpop. We'd love to hear from you. Support for WAMC comes from Curtis Lumber, providing kitchens, baths, doors, and windows, paint, flooring, and more since 1890 with 21 locations in New York and northern Vermont. CurtisLumber.com. Café La Perche, Hudson, New York. Boulangerie Lounge and Bistro, serving breakfast, lunch, dinner, and weekend brunch. CafeLaPerche.com. Bel Air Mountain Ski Center, now managed by the New York State Olympic Regional Development Authority, New York's winter snow park, BelAir.com. And Edward Jones Uptown Kingston. Risa Condi, Edward Jones Financial Advisor, Making Sense of Investing, 845-331-6293. That's it for the show. Thanks again for joining us. Zach Malloy, our engineer. The phone's answered by Bruce Herbach. I'm Ray Graff. That's me, Graff. I can say my own name. Okay, time for a second cup of coffee then. Tomorrow it's Pets and Vets. Stay tuned for a news update.